live from Burbank, California, home of the Bob Hope Airport. Funniest place to die in a plane crash. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now he was created in a lab.
Ah, man.
Mark Maron.
Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, pain sponges, need machines, and all the people that I went to high school with that didn't show up. Man, I went to my high school reunion Saturday night, Jim. Saturday night, the big high school reunion is about 112 people there.
Nobody showed up, huh?
Nah, it was about 150, and I got to be honest with you, it was actually pretty good. It was pretty satisfying. What few people that were there, it was satisfying in ways that I had no idea. For one, the guy, the quarterback from high school, Chris Russo, this guy that was this like little buff, you know, feathered blonde hair guy, real ass, not a nice guy to me, little, you know, chubby guy with the, you know, with the Rolling Stones tongue on the jacket, you know, hey buddy, what's up? You know, little Mark Maron, funny, hey, like me, Mark Maron. This guy was an ass to me, all right? And now this guy must weigh about 300 pounds. He's got no hair, and he's got a big fat wife, and he just looks awful. It looks like he just can't stop eating. You would have hated him.
So he burned out too early, huh? Is what you're saying.
I don't know what the hell happened to him, but for me, it was nothing but closure. It was like, oh, look at that.
So I'm taking it, you didn't go there, you know, meet new friends, network, and, you know, just say, hey, how you doing?
It's my high school reunion. And here's the funny thing. Did not say word one to that fat pig. Didn't say nothing to him. Didn't say hello to him or nothing, because I don't resent him anymore, and I wanted to say that.
Really?
But you know what's weird is that all the jocks sat at the corner table, and they did that thing. They kind of isolated themselves, and they kind of cloistered themselves over there. There was another guy, Danny, who he also put on maybe 200 pounds, lost all his hair, wears a cowboy hat. And when I saw him, he's looking at my little picture on my pin, mm-hmm. and he's like, Mark, and he puts a big dip of chew into his mouth. He's like, I think I remember you. And I just welled up with satisfaction at what his life must be like at this point. And what else was interesting? I think I fared better than most of the fellas. And I would like to say that what was surprising to my wife and to me as well is that really the women fared much better than the men. And that's that goes against folk wisdom that men age better than women. I found that most of the women looked better than they did in high school. There was one girl who I had a crush on. And again, I'm spacing her name out. Literally had, I was obsessed with her throughout, I don't know what year of high school it was. I had rolling obsessions. There were two or three or four.
It was Miss Rogers, your science professor.
No, this wasn't one of the professors. And I didn't have anything for the professors at this particular school. But I do remember being completely obsessed with this girl. And I told her, and she had no idea, of course. I'm not even sure she really remembered me. But, you know, there is that part of you that I felt a lot of people, you know, divorces, some people had four kids. I saw enough of the people that I went to school with to feel it was kind of heartwarming, to be honest with you. I recommend going to your reunion.
See, I can't do that because everybody I knew was, all my friends were in the year before me, 1976.
Yeah.
And you know what I discovered about them?
What?
They're going to hold their 50th. I think they probably already did. But
their 50th? Well, you mean 50th, their 30th?
30th.
Or yeah, yeah, 30th.
And did you have any famous people graduate from your class?
No.
Because we had, like, Martin Hewitt, or whatever his name was, the star of Blue Lagoon.
Yeah.
And somebody went on to make nuclear missiles.
Uh-huh.
And another guy who is still wanted for a Brinks job, for a $1.5 million Brinks job that he was inside on.
So you had a guy that got away with a lot of money. You got mm-hmm. another guy that helped facilitate the killings of thousands, perhaps. And you had another guy that is a has-been now.
Jealous?
Yeah, a little bit.
See?
I got awarded that night. They had a little award ceremony. I was got the most unusual job, the most unusual career. And I think they were sort of goading me to come up and do some stand-up. And I just couldn't even fathom it. Could not even, you know, consider it in my head to do it. Because this is the reason I never went to my reunions, is that I don't have a level of fame that would make it undeniable to everybody the sheer power of me. Do you understand? I can't walk into the situation and everybody in the room goes, I can't believe Mark Maron came. He's so famous. No, that's not the way it goes. I got a lot of this. I saw you like 5 years ago on a thing. Are you still doing that? Yeah, proudly, I say. I am still doing that. But I felt like I was in better shape than a lot of them. And my friend David was there. It was great. I recommend going to your reunion for just because you'd be surprised at the humanity of it. Even the people you didn't like, a friend of mine, Tom Shalhoub, captured it well, is that you see these people, like somebody like Chris Russo, like that jock, and you look at them, and you see the guy that you went to high school with kind of trapped in this fat. You know, like you see his little high school face in there, and he's just surrounded by 25 years of whatever the hell his life did to him. But he looks like the guy's still in there, kind of crying for help or sort of saying, "What's up, douchebag?" In that case, you know, that would have been the situation. "What's up, douchebag?" And I had a great time. I saw my dad. That was depressing but uplifting. I told my wife on the way to the show, on the way to see my father, I said, if I can come away learning one thing about myself that I will not do from here on out from my father, then it will be a successful trip.
Did you?
Every time, sure. But it's just a matter of keeping the lid on it. I don't know if I can stop it. You know, my dad is one of these. He's like you. He's a buzzkill guy. Like, you know,
excuse
he's,
me, what?
I'm sorry, did something...
Yeah,
did
something came out. Is that something your dad used to do?
Yeah, that's what my dad still does.
Yeah, say inappropriate and inaccurate things?
Yeah, no.
To people who are your best assets right now?
No. Buzzkill, I think we've said on the air before.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any surprise in these things.
Oh, man, you know, you are going to get the bitch slap into your life after during the break.
From who? That German girl who's here?
I hope so. I'd like to see that.
No, my dad's the kind of guy that's sort of like, God, you know, that'd be great if your show didn't get canceled. And, you know, you don't be awful is that, you know, if you actually got into an accident and lost your vocal cords because then you wouldn't be able to do anything. It's like, how the hell do we get here? How do we get from, you know, sad your show's getting canceled? He's that kind of guy. It's like, you used to be a pretty good guitar player. Imagine if you didn't have a hand, you know? I'm sorry, I didn't even, Charlie is actually missing a hand, and I have this embarrassing moment where I wasn't even referring to Charlie, and then I had that moment where, how the hell, out of left field do I say that, and then Charlie's like holding his no hand up, and I'm like, I'm an ass, I am an ass. But that was no, come on, Charlie, you know you don't have a hand, I'm not saying anything that you, Oh, God, let's just do a show.
Okay.
Now I'm sweating. I feel bad.
No, that's okay, man. Everything is all right. Don't worry about it.
No, it's like that scene in in that Cheech and Chong movie where the guy's like, you know, don't say anything about his scar, man. And then right when he shows up, he's like, a Z? You remember that?
No, I never watched that movie.
You never liked Cheech and Chong? What,
no.
Were you too good for Cheech and Chong?
Let's
plug the show here, can we? Patton Oswalt's going to be in a little later. Ed Burns, we're going to talk to on the phone, the star and director and writer of the new film, The Groomsman. Frank Schaefer is, as we speak, in the lounge enjoying some coffee. He's the co-author of AWOL, The Unexcused Absence of America's Upper Classes from Military Service and How It Hurts the Country. What is with people in the big, long subtitles? Ricardo Pollack will be here. He's the director of 18 with a Bullet. That's a PBS wide-angle special that I believe airs in most places tomorrow night about the gangs of San Salvador in El Salvador. It's amazing. I didn't. Well, I'll talk to him about it. What'd you do over the weekend, Jim? Let's try to pull me out of this hole that I've dug myself into.
I went to the Lotus Festival in Echo Park Lake.
Uh huh. Oh, how was that? I hear the lotuses didn't show up. Is that true?
There are a couple of blooming lotuses, yes, but it was very nice. There's a lot of people, and the fireworks were great too. I've never seen fireworks like that before.
Are you serious?
Serious, yes. They had different patterns to them.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, you go to July 4th fireworks, they always, you know, blam, blam, blam things. But this had kind of like an Asian type fireworks pattern to it.
I'm not, you need to paint a better picture for me.
They had different type of swirling, waving back and forth shooters and explosions that exploded differently than you usually see them.
Uh-huh.
And different sounds, and it was more artistic, not a bunch of just power that you usually see at July 4th, you know, where we go blam, 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 big stick, blam, 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 as opposed to the more sensitive Asian Lotus Festival.
I got to be honest with you, I think that most fireworks are Asian. I don't want to break it to you, but I think that all fireworks are Asian.
Well, maybe so. Asian, origin, maybe.
Yeah.
Like, all concrete came from Rome, ancient Rome.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's too boring to mention. Uh-huh. Thanks for bringing that up, by the way.
No, the Lotus Festival here, I think it takes on a sort of Mexico-Eurasian feel, right?
Yeah, but it was highly Asian.
Oh, okay. And did you eat some Asian food?
Yes, there was a lot of cold vegetarian rolls there. You would have liked it had you not been, you know, gloating over poor fat people down.
You are one to talk. All of a sudden, Mr. Sympathetic to the fat cause. Mr., you know, every other word out of his mouth, obesity is a problem and they're to blame.
It is. You should have helped that man.
I did. I reached out to him. I had some great Mexican food. We'll be back with Ricardo Pollock on what is turning out to be just an excellent show so far. Let's see if we can, like, regauge this or reload it or the hell with it.
Many of the younger gang members have grown up without their parents. Sochi's mother left him to work in America when he was 6 months old.
My love for my mother and my love for the gang are two different things. I love my gang more than my mother, because when I needed her, she wasn't there for me. But when I needed the gang, it was there for me. I know my future is in prison, the hospital, possibly even death. I'm 17 and I'd like to reach 37 at least, or 39.
That, what you're listening to is from 18 with a Bullet. It is a wide-angle presentation. It will be on PBS tomorrow night. El Salvador has been a country in a struggle of one kind or another for years. Prolonged civil war in the 80s and 90s left a trail of death and a trail of guns lying around the country. Unfortunately, many of those guns are finding their way into the hands of rival youth gangs that have taken over the projects in San Salvador and moved throughout the country. What is even more distressing is that many of the boy soldiers in these youth gangs got their gang training in the States before they were deported for one reason or another, usually criminal activity. 18 with a Bullet gives us an intimate look at one of the gangs, the 18, and how their lives are wasted in a bloody petty feud over turf and how poverty and drugs plays into it. It will be showing on PBS, as I said. The director of 18 with a Bullet, Ricardo Pollock, is on the phone with us from London. How are you, Ricardo?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm very good. So why don't we get right out. The name of the gang that you spend the most time with, is it just the 18 or is it the...
Yeah, I mean, you know, they just refer to it as 18 or the 18 as a whole.
Okay.
The name comes from 18th Street in Los Angeles, but they tend to just call it 18.
Well, let's talk about that right off the bat. Explain the connection between the gangs of San Salvador and the gangs of Los Angeles.
Well, until you know, criminals began to be deported from Los Angeles, there were no street gangs as you see them now in San Salvador. What happened was that, you know, young Latinos who had basically lived most of their lives in cities like L.A., San Diego, or Houston, got into trouble with the law and were deported to San Salvador, a country they couldn't really remember and had lived in for 6 months of their lives when they were born. They got there and they did what they knew best, which was gangbanging, basically, and they formed the gangs that they were members of in the States in Central America.
Okay, now how many kids are we talking about here?
It's difficult to have accurate figures, but estimates are probably somewhere between 25 and 40,000.
That is unbelievable.
That's in a country of about 6 million.
Now, yeah, most of the kids you spoke to are part of one particular set of projects. And I don't know, maybe I never really noticed in the limited exposure that I've had to gang culture, but these really, I mean, in your film... They really are kids.
They're young.
Yeah, and I never really noticed that before, but you really get the feeling that a lot of them, although they have lost their innocence for most practical purposes, still come off as relatively innocent kids. Maybe it's just because they haven't experienced life yet.
Well, they are 16 and 17.
Yeah.
You know, some of them still crave their mothers, many of whom live in the States. So that's the same thing that struck me, actually, was, you know, I suppose if one says gangs, street gangs, you know, you think of these monsters. And what I wanted to do was really to paint a far more intimate portrait of them so that you could see them as they really were. And so see the violence in some kind of context, really. I think, you know, that's what I was trying to do with the film.
Well, I think you definitely captured that because, you know, in our culture, the way that gang violence and gang members have become mythic is, you know, primarily through music and certainly through violence in the streets. But the way the pop culture myth operates is that these guys are just, you know, real gangsters of one kind or another. And for some reason, when I saw these these gangbangers in your film, I was like, oh my God, is it, you know, there's no hope for these kids. They're just kids and they're running around killing each other over nothing. What do you think is the primary causes for this? Is it poverty?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm really pleased actually that you see the film in that way, because, you know, my own feeling was of the tragedy of the situation. You know, as you say, gang culture is glamorized. You know, it's supposed to be sexy. You know, that's how we in, you know, in Britain and the States portray gang culture. And my feeling out there was there was nothing sexy about it. It was grim. It was depressing. You know, there was a lot of poverty. I mean, you know, there's a lot of poor people in El Salvador who don't join a gang. There's a lot of kids whose parents have abandoned them who don't join a gang. There's a lot of kids with access to weapons who join a gang. But when you combine all those, you know, you get a pretty lethal cocktail, and I think you get a higher propensity for people joining gangs. Boredom, lack of opportunity. It's dramatic.
And
you know, if you're like a 16-year-old kid and there's nothing going for you, and you join a gang and you go out and kill your enemy, life seems more interesting.
Well, I think that's true, and I think that you really see that, and I think that all those different factors really lead into this idea that, you know, the gang mentality, it's really a belief system. You know, it's very limited, it's territorial, but there is definitely an ideology and a belief system that defines these kids and gives their life purpose. And I just think that it seems like for most of them, and they even know this, there's really no hope, and they're willing to die for this belief system as long as they go out, sticking to it.
And the sad thing is that the culture and the belief system that they've adopted is one that glorifies that, you know, glorifies death. It glorifies the idea that you die young.
Yeah.
And so the sad thing is, I suppose, is when you see the 15 and 16-year-olds that you get to know in one context, and they're kids, and that you chat away with them, and they hang out, and you know, they are, as you say, they're charming, they're sweet, they're funny, they're almost innocent. And it's almost as if they're brainwashed into the gang ideology. And because it's the gang ideology that glorifies death, you know that probably that's where they're going to end up, either that or in prison, which is, you know, probably the safest option for them in many cases.
Well, thank you for joining us, Ricardo Pollock. It's a great film, and I definitely encourage people to see it. I appreciate you being with
us. Okay, thanks very much.
You take care.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye. We'll be back with Frank Schaefer to talk about some other stuff, you know, more importantly, why rich people don't go into the military and what it means to America. Stay with us.
Now he's a symbol of corporate excess, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. You know, after the first segment, and then we had an interview, and then we have a break.
Yes.
I'm trying to regroove the show. This is our last of what is this, like the fifth to, what is it, the fourth to the last show? We got four shows left after this one.
Yes.
And I don't want to be a negative. I don't want to have a negative attitude. And I'm trying to turn the ship around because, you know, it got bungled up at the beginning. Now, you tell me it's your birthday, something you're hiding. Laughing Andy, it's his birthday. What is with you guys not announcing the birthdays? Don't you realize how exciting it is that you're turning 50 and Andy's turning 40, on the same day?
That's the only reason you brought it up, to do that dumb joke?
Yeah, it is. No, I brought it up because
I see why you're hit with the college crowds.
I don't hide my birthday generally. I like getting a little attention on my birthday. I think most people do. And you chose to have a sad, quiet birthday donut by yourself with our next guest in the green room.
We went to a little Lotus Festival at Echo Park Lake. And
that was the birthday thing?
Yeah, we did. You know, had some people over and everything.
You had people over?
Yeah.
No, that must have been nice.
Yep.
Wow, I'm really not on the inner circle with you. Really.
You were out of town. You were in Arizona.
Okay, all right.
Making
all right.
fun of, you know.
New Mexico, but that's okay.
Less fortunate people at your high school were
your union.
Don't even begin to claim an upper hand. Don't even to claim a higher ground, Jim, on that level.
Well, I was making fun of people at my birthday.
Happy birthday, Jim. That's all I want to say. And I think that as
I'm
the
not
next,
50.
I know you're 42, whatever you are.
47.
Well, there you go. Well, thank you for being honest. That's very nice.
And for the German audience member in the background,
you're 42.
Ich habe meine Geburtstag. Today.
This is so wonderful to have a woman in the room to watch, you know, five grown men act like a bunch of idiots. It's really tremendous just to see, like, everyone like, hey, can I get you a coffee or something to eat? And you're talking German and, wow, man, this is tremendous. Happy birthday, Jim. And I'm glad you're here because this need for all of us to express ourselves and charm you is running the show into the toilet. Thank you for coming. I appreciate it. I'm kidding. It's very nice to have you. Now let's get into some serious business, can we? Our president was a privileged kid and AWOL during the Vietnam War. Vice president sought deferment after deferment to avoid serving in the Vietnam War. The Speaker of the House avoided serving in the Vietnam War. Now these men shamelessly send American soldiers to die in an unnecessary occupation, my opinion. And what is worse is that they are completely out of touch with how those soldiers live and feel and the sense of duty that defines them because they never experience it. Personally, I find them condescending to the military, and the fact that this president hides the coffins of men coming home dead and has never attended a military funeral is insulting, I believe. The book AWOL, The Unexcused Absence of America's Upper Class from Military Service and How It Hurts Our Country, deals with this disconnect between political leaders, the upper class, and the soldiers on the ground. The co-author of the book, Frank Schaefer, is here in studio with us. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Thanks, Mark.
Now, you are a self-proclaimed Republican, and this is not a partisan issue, is it?
It is not. And my co-author, Kathy Roth Duque, worked in the Clinton White House and has spent apparently her whole life raising money for Democratic causes. And she and I got together on this project and decided to write a book because of our personal experience. My son joined the Marine Corps right out of high school mm-hmm. at the same time as I had a kid at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown, another one at NYU. It was a big surprise to us. I never served in the military, didn't have a clue. And when Kathy got out of the Clinton White House, she wound up marrying a Marine. And essentially, both of us had to ask a question, and that was, why are all our friends so surprised at what, in her case, her husband was doing, and in my case, my son was doing, as if somehow they had taken a lower path than they would have been expected to take? Because, frankly, both Kathy and I come from that part of American culture that you could call the kind of educated, upper middle class, the sort of people who, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, just don't serve anymore. And their kids certainly don't. So, you know, AWOL is a book about a journey two people took from being, I guess, cultural snobs and disconnected from the people in our military to being very much connected through the gut and the heart.
Well, it's interesting because this is an all-volunteer army, so all-volunteer military, unless you're in the Guard or the Reserves. But
sure.
it's interesting that the way the dialogue has changed is that when people were drafted, you know, if they had connections or they had money
right.
or they had some way to circumvent actually going, mm-hmm. getting a stateside job or getting out of it altogether, that was still imposed upon them. Now, as a volunteer, it is interesting because when I hear people who I know of this class, where you're like, your first thought is, really? I mean, couldn't you get out of it? But it's a
right.
volunteer situation.
That's correct. Yeah.
So what was your feeling when your son told you that he was going to go? I mean, what
well,
did that?
Well, basically, it was surprise, chagrin, somewhat shocked, and you know, what happened? What went wrong here? And then a lot of soul searching, as in, why is that my attitude? Why do I believe on one hand that we need a military, and on the other hand, think it always ought to be somebody else who does the heavy lifting?
Mm-hmm.
Now, he joined before 9/11. He joined when Clinton was in the White House, before Afghanistan, before Iraq. Wound up serving during that period of time, did two combat tours in Afghanistan and one mission to Iraq. Everything changed, but basically my attitude changed, not toward the military in terms of political mission or what I think of George Bush or don't think of George Bush.
Right.
What changed was this kind of social, cultural distance and snobbery between the class that serves and the class that doesn't. I mean, it's like two gated communities in this country.
Sure.
There's one group that does all the heavy lifting and is asked to make all the sacrifices. the group that talks the most about these issues, has the most decision-making power from the president on down, are the group least associated. You know, when you, in our book, AWOL, we talk about Eleanor Roosevelt's diary, in mm-hmm. which she says that her husband would have been ashamed if all five of his kids were not in uniform at the time Roosevelt was commander-in-chief. We've gone from that to a period of history where you know, the editor of the New York Times and George Bush may hate each other and disagree on everything, but one thing they agree with each other on, tacitly anyway, is that neither of them have a boot camp graduation picture of a kid on their desk. So the powerful and the wealthy and the connected don't send their kids into military service. And so the information loop has been cut. That gut-level uh-huh. connection is not there anymore between the people who make all the decisions and the people who do the heavy lifting.
Well, let's talk about that, because it seems to me that it is specifically a class issue, and it has a lot to do with the issue of people who enter the service. Yeah, most of the time, they have no choice.
Right.
They might have been troubled kids. They need to figure out how to make a living, and they accept that about the war, about the military service. It's not an issue of duty as much as it is necessity, because of their social class. So when did this shift happen? Because I think in terms of World War II and probably even up through Korea, there was really an American sense of duty and loyalty and commitment.
Right.
And it was almost there wasn't a second thought about it, where you have people like John F. Kennedy, George
sure.
H.W. Bush. They joined the military because they had a sense of duty, and it was a different environment then.
Yeah, I mean, in AWOL, one of the statistics we cite in the book is that in 1956, 70% of the graduating class of some of our top universities like Princeton and so forth did military service. In fact, it was over half until the late 1950s. And then, of course, Vietnam came and all sorts of cultural changes. But the real shift today is that the spirit of the student deferments of the 1960s and early 1970s was carried forward into the all-volunteer era. And basically what's happened now is that whoever's president, whether it's a Bill Clinton or a George Bush, whomever it might be, politics aside, there's a class of Americans that just don't have any idea of sharing responsibility or obligation in terms of military service, but any kind of service. I mean, look, there's a trajectory that goes from expensive daycare to expensive private schools to expensive high schools to expensive colleges to top-paying jobs. And along the way, the only person a certain class of American is going to meet who does something different is maybe their doorman or their doorman's kid. It's not only a question of money, it's also a question of education. So that, you know, you have a very insular upper middle class that is basically increasingly cut off from people in other walks of life. There are very few areas of American
yeah.
life where the playing field is level or gets leveled. One of the things I found with my son John that I talk about in both AWOL, this book, and a previous book I wrote called Keeping Faith, is the fact that he had the privilege of working for 5 years as a Marine with Americans of all classes, of all colors, of all economic backgrounds, people he never would have met in any other trajectory that I can project for his life. And it connected our family in a completely different way, both to the country, but also to a whole class of American people and individuals as well as groups that other than paying lip service to diversity and all this stuff that everybody talks about, in reality, the kind of people that I work with as an author, agents and publishers in the literary community, academics and these kind of people, never touch.
Mm-hmm.
So that one of the things that's been lost in terms of who serves and who doesn't is this kind of leveling of the playing field. It's just another area in which America is becoming a country divided between its elites and everybody else.
And it's going to become more so that, it seems to me, that we're not on a trajectory that's going to bring those, you know, if the middle class is dissolving from all indications because of policy. But we don't even need to get into that. I mean, I think what we should get into is what does it mean for the sense of what being an American is supposed to mean when you have a hypocrisy, where you have somebody like George Bush, who is clearly AWOL to some degree, whatever confusion there is around that, he avoided serving in Vietnam.
Right.
You know, what do you do when you have a vice president who clearly sought deferment over deferment over mm-hmm. deferment because he didn't feel like he owed his country that, and these people were, you know, moving into politics and were protected by politicians at the
sure.
time, so that they can't even pay lip service to a sense of military commitment. And what do you make of that? I mean, why are these guys leaders, and why do people keep listening to them?
Well, the fact of the matter is this cuts both right and left. I mean, the same would be true of the leadership of the Democratic Party as it is of the Republican Party. And that's why in our book AWOL we're saying, look, this is much more of a class issue than it is a political issue. And the fact of the matter is our political leading people and the class they represent, which mainly is very wealthy people these days, given what it costs to run for office and all the rest of it, and the leadership class in academia and in the press and in the media, they may all have disagreements, but basically they occupy the same kind of environment and the same kind of social climate, and that climate does not include military service, and that's an enormous change for this country.
Well, let's talk about the implications of that change and what it means to this country in your book, and what it means to the future of this country in terms of why it is bad for the country. I'd also like to talk about there is a certain number of people from that class that enter as officers or enter on higher levels, which with my father did in the Air Force. But our guest is Frank Schaefer. The book is AWOL, The Unexcused Absence of America's Upper Class from Military Service and How It Hurts Our Country. We'll be talking about how that hurts our country in just a second.
He's getting out of the phone book business, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Our guest in studio, Frank Schaefer, the author of AWOL, The Unexcused Absence of America's Upper Class from Military Service and How It Hurts Our Country. When my father enlisted in the Air Force in the late 60s, he was he was already out of medical school, so he was able to enlist as an officer. And there was a trend of that. There was a trend of a certain type of person that may not have been from what we're talking about, the lower class, who was able to enroll at an officer level or get into West Point or get into, like, there is an upper echelon to the military.
Sure.
Yes?
Sure.
Now, let's just talk specifically, I guess, not about that, but about what impact does this have on the country that you have this incredible dichotomy, that you have that the sense of loyalty or duty to America in terms of the military has been diluted by corporatism, I think, and that by even on the individual level that people know, it's like, I imagine when your son got into it, he was going to learn something. He wasn't going to fight a war.
Right, that's right. And he got in, as I said, in 1999 before the current situation arose, and now he's done his 5 years. He's out. He's in college. But you were right, just to go back to the point you mentioned earlier, there is obviously a leadership class that is involved in the military, but it's a gated community. You have a lot of sons of fathers, of grandfathers, and so forth, who carry on that tradition, who are from very educated, often well-off families, but they do not necessarily come from what you would call the general non-serving public. It's sort of a self-sustaining loop, where you have the sons of a father, and so forth and so on. Increasingly, the military is drawn from a couple of sources. One is military families. You have a kid grow up on a military base, 2-3 brothers, a sister. One or two of them go into the military. Second is from the middle and lower middle class. Third is just what you brought up, and that is the leading echelons of the military family. But what doesn't happen is that the military no longer represents what you might call a broad swath of the American cultural scene or a cross-section. People tend to think of the military as Republican or toward the right in terms of who serves or how they vote. People tend to think of the military often as evangelical and Christian these days because there's a kind of conservatism to it. But a lot of that is by default. It's because people from the left have quit volunteering and don't come in. And sometimes there are exceptions to that rule. And when they do, it's healthy because it means that the military doesn't belong to any one group or one socioeconomic group or one point of view. It truly is more representative of the American people.
But so that isn't something that defines the left, I think, and defines contemporary progressive ideas is an anti-war stance.
Yeah, but the funny thing is, you know, the most anti-war group of people in the country that I've met are people in the military. You know, my son is a Marine, and the last thing he wanted to do was go to Afghanistan and get shot at. And the last thing his family wanted to do was have him there. And one of the problems of not having a cross-section volunteering for the military that come from what you might call the chattering classes and the political leadership is it's too easy to use our military. I mean, if George Bush had listened to a lot of the military leaders, we would not be in Iraq right now. The people who drag their feet and kick the hardest against overuse of the military are the military themselves. you know, you hear all sorts of things. We ought to do something about Darfur. We ought to do something about this. We ought to do something about that. But often the people who are making those statements don't have a connection to the people who will do the heavy lifting, and they certainly often are not heading down to the recruiter's office to volunteer.
Right, but isn't it also true that the way they wanted to design the military, you know, towards the end of Clinton's presidency and towards Rumsfeld's reign now,
sure,
is to make it lean, to make it sort of combat ready, to not
right.
be a military that is about, you know, avoiding military conflict,
right.
but a military that is available to manage military conflicts and get in there and do what they need to do in this new and unfolding perpetual war that they have visioned.
Yeah.
So, and if I know that, it would seem to me that people entering the military, you know, realize that that's the task at hand. And I think that since we are moving away from defending the country and actively doing things that are first strike mentality.
Sure.
That, you know, that is a different world in terms of how the military
That's
functions.
True, except the only thing I would the only thing I'd add to that is that you can't separate the military from the rest of the culture. I mean, either we're a democracy and we
right.
all participate or we
okay.
don't. The fact there are corrupt politicians or that we don't like a lot of what Washington does not mean that we refuse to serve on juries or stop voting or tell everybody we know don't run for office. It's a dirty game.
Understood.
I mean, we're going to participate or we're not. So that the idea of waiting until the military policy and or national policy is in good enough shape for us to get involved ourselves is something that if we applied to the whole of our culture, nobody would vote, nobody would participate in anything.
That's happening.
It's happening. That's true. You're right. There's a general level of cynicism there. And part of the cynicism is, going back to the basic argument of AWOL, is that we live in a culture that's increasingly class-ridden. And one symptom of that
yeah.
is what's happened in the military. It isn't the cause. It's a symptom.
So what happens? So now what do we do to change this? So I understand that the liability of this and the reason it's caused is because it's a class situation, and it's a very distinct class situation. So that's how it hurts the country. So
right.
Now, without, you know, talking policy and, you know, reinvigorating the middle class somehow
sure.
or reinvigorating a sense of duty and honesty and transparency in this country, what is the solution?
Well, in AWOL, the last third of the book talks about the solution. And what we do is, first of all, draw on the work of other people. But in terms of our own discussion that we have in the book, Kathy and I propose, first of all, reinvigorated sense of service, not necessarily just military service. I favor a return to the draft with a non-military component. So if people don't want to serve in the military, they don't have to. But the idea that you can be on a trajectory from youth to adulthood without once being asked to do anything for your country besides make money and better yourself financially, materially, in terms of our materialistic culture, I think has to stop. Now, I don't think it has a chance in hell of happening, but I think the discussion has to start somewhere.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
mandated civic duty.
Yeah, mandated civic duty. That the idea that you can just, you know, get out there and start reaping a profit the minute you can do it without any backward look at anything in terms of a higher or nobler cause or any sense of community or responsibility for the guy next to you is really hurting us. And so I think mandated civic duty is something that we really need to start talking about, whatever our politics.
Well, the Peace Corps was a part of that, wasn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And you know, but here's a little story my co-author Kathy told me.
We're going to have to wait on it.
Sure.
We are out of time, and we got to bring this over the top. So our guest is Frank Schaefer. The book is AWOL, The Unexcused Absence of America's Upper Class from Military Service and How It Hurts Our Country. We'll be back with him in just a second.
Please update your PayPal account.
Thank you, Jim. Frank Schaefer is our guest. AWOL, The Unexcused Absence of America's Upper Class from Military Service and How It Hurts Our Country, is the book. Before we went on break there, Jim brought up the Peace Corps, and then we had a conversation on the break about this sense that class issue has always existed, but
sure.
it did not necessarily, because you've always heard, certainly in the conflicts coming up from World War II, I guess, that, you know, the blacks were sent in first, or
mm-hmm.
and now that we hear stories about, you know, the Mexicans are being sent in first, that there was always this disposable entity
mm-hmm.
towards some of the lower classes of this country, even the white lower classes, but that that wasn't always the case.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is, you know, human beings being what they are, there's always going to be something terrible going on when it comes to any human endeavor, war not being an exception. But there used to be this idea that if you had been given a lot, you owed something. And there was an idea of honorable service, not just in the military, but across the board. I mean, we had gentlemen farmers who were millionaires in their time who went up and served in Congress for a while and then went back to their farms. The same idea about military service. You know, go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, look at the portraits in the American wing. You're going to see most of the leading members of the leading families at one time or another in military uniforms, certainly the males. It was just considered something you did. We've lost that. But we haven't, as we were talking about before the break, lost that only in the area of military service. You know, when you look at a story my co-author Kathy Roth tells, you know, her husband had just come back from Iraq with a helicopter squadron that he was a commander of. You know, they were back a couple of weeks. What happens? Hurricane Katrina hits. Who's got to go down and rescue people off rooftops? Same guys who have just been away from their family for 7 months. I mean, the fact of the matter is we have a small group of people in this country who are asked to give everything while George Bush tells the rest of the country to go shopping. I mean, that was his answer for 9/11. Go shopping, help the economy. It was not a call to either drive smaller cars so that we wouldn't be dependent on the people who were paying Al-Qaeda to start with. It was not go down to your recruiter's office, we're going to volunteer, and guess what? Both of my daughters went down this afternoon, and our family is going to lead by example. That whole idea of moral responsibility shared by everybody is being lost.
It's interesting because it seems that in the evolution of what's become the Republican Party, and maybe politics in general, but has they feed on that. I mean, it seems to me that there's a lot to be gained from people in power who don't care about the national fabric as much as maintaining power and ruling in the favor of corporatocracy.
Right.
That they gain a lot by people not taking responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, and as I mentioned, I think during the break, in 1917 when the draft was instituted in the First World War, the reason Congress gave was that they were afraid that so many of the kids from our elite colleges were volunteering from the leading families that the future leadership class would all be stripped and killed and taken out, and they wanted more of the middle class and, quote, lower classes to volunteer. We've gone from that to the point now where you have politicians of both parties, left, right, in between all points of the compass politically. And as we said earlier, you know, where they have a commonality is not with my kid, not with my family. Let somebody else do it. And you can't have a moral leadership that does not lead from the front. And the Republican Party right now is led by men who do not lead from the front. What they do is they ask other people to do the sacrificing. And basically, you know, are experts in photo ops with the troops. But, you know, their kid is not standing there. And, you know, if you talk, we cite an example in the book in AWOL that Charlie Moskos gives, who's a leading sociologist and studies these issues, talked to a bunch of recruiters at a meeting and said, you know, if you could choose to have the recruiting budget of the U.S. military doubled or have one of the Bush twins volunteer, which would you take? And they weren't being facetious. Every single one of them said, I'd rather have the president's daughter volunteer. You know, our problems would be over. Charlie Moskos has another thing that's interesting. He's saying that in terms of his studies of both the United States and other democracies, the word is democracy here, conflicts in which all classes do not participate. In other words, if just the lower or middle class is participating or being asked to sacrifice and not the upper classes, this absence of leading from the front cannot be sustained. That long-term support across the board doesn't materialize. And the reason for that is whether people are thinking her through or not, it's a fundamentally immoral situation. And that's exactly what we're facing
now. I would imagine it's something that you see in dictatorships or monarchies a lot.
Hey, look, the Persian army was a slave army whipped into action by the monarch's servants. That's not what the United States is supposed to be all
exactly.
about.
Exactly. So now what I want to know, especially given that there is certainly an amazing conflict around, you know, the redefinition of foreign policy and around how the military is being used, I don't know how you're going to reinvigorate this interest if some element of transparency isn't introduced to, you know, what it means to be part of the American military for real.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is somebody has to begin changing this. I mean, it's like the old color bar or any of these other things. You know, nothing's going to happen by itself. And sooner or later, there has to be a public awareness that we're talking about an AWOL, and also in another book of mine coming out this fall called Baby Jack, which is a novel about a Marine who gets killed in Iraq from a very wealthy, upscale Boston family. You know, both of these books, now AWOL in print, and that one not yet out, Baby Jack not yet out. But what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do through this writing, is basically introduce the idea that this is an unacceptable position. And, you know, it starts with art. It starts with novels. It starts with films. It starts with literature. It starts with stand-up comics like you talking about it. People have got to begin to work material that essentially says, we're not going to put up with this anymore. This is wrong. This is ugly. It doesn't matter who you voted for. Doesn't matter what your politics are. What matters is that we live in a country that has a basic fairness to it. This is an unfair situation.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Frank Schaefer. It's great talking to you. The book is AWOL, The Unexcused Absence of America's Upper Class from Military Service and How It Hurts Our Country. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for having me.
We'll be back with, I've just been informed, Donald Logue instead of Ed Burns from the film The Groomsman.
Whipped cream and other delights. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Surprise shifto changeo, the show's schedule. Instead of Ed Burns, we get, I think, probably a more interesting star. A more interesting talent, my friends. The first time I remember Donald Logue was from those weird MTV image spots as the twisted Jimmy the cab driver with the busted horn rims. Donald has gone on to have an impressive career in television and movies, from Jerry Maguire to The Tao of Steve to ER to the short-lived but great series Grounded for Life. He is now starring in The Groomsman, the new Ed Burns film, alongside of Ed, Jay Moore, John Leguizamo, Brittany Murphy. He's with us on the phone. How are you, Donald Logue?
I'm good, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, man. You've been in a lot of stuff. I went to your IMDb and I'm like, holy crap, this guy has never stopped working.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Dude, it's out of complete and utter paranoia and fear.
Well, I'm glad that I go right from that to anger, which a lot of people don't find very.
Fear is the birth of anger.
Yes.
That's where it comes from, exactly.
But you seem to at least be able to manage negotiations and being charming enough to further your career with your fear.
Well, I'm still in fear. I haven't gotten to anger yet.
All right. So now, do you find that people know you for you, or are you still that guy from that thing?
Yeah, I'm mostly that guy who looks familiar to them from that thing.
Yeah? Do you ever get
but
mad
that
at
that thing being high school?
Have you had that moment where you're like, where someone comes up to you and go, hey, wait, I know you, and you're like, yeah, it must be from my television series or the films I was in, and they're like, nah, that's not it.
Yeah, I haven't really had that moment. I just, but they're always awkward, and they're always as awkward as you describe.
Yeah. So
yeah, I've never had the self-satisfied, perhaps you've seen me on television.
You never did that?
Yeah, no.
All right. So The Groomsman I think all these guys seem real familiar to me. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs, and why don't you tell us a little bit about the part you play and the rest of the guys in the movie?
I play I play Ed's older brother in the movie, who's incredibly embittered because his younger brother is just, and it's probably not unlike life itself. It's like he's more successful, better looking. He's about to embark upon a really happy marriage, have kids, and just, I'm one of those guys who doesn't see that their life sucks because they've made it so. They just see the universe being incredibly unfairly aligned against them.
Hold on, that would be the Mark Maron story, what you just described.
Isn't it so true, man? You and I could just bond over a few beers over this one.
Oh, man. Yeah, boy, if I were drinking, yeah.
Exactly, the way the universe has screwed us. And so he takes it out on everybody else instead of just kind of like being honest with his wife and saying, I've got these problems going on, I'm afraid to be vulnerable and open up to you. He just is like, I'll be such a jerk that I will drive you from me, which is another kind of quality that a lot of people seem to possess.
Yeah, so it's you. You play Ed Burns' brother. He's getting married, right?
Right.
Which is kind of interesting because the character of his fiance is already pregnant.
Yes.
Which is, that's interesting because I was realizing today that that's something you would have never seen in movies 20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly, and that people are mellow with it.
Right, exactly.
Right.
It would have been like this shameful, horrible thing that they were trying to hide.
Right, no, yeah, exactly, not that at all.
So, and the other guys that are in it, Jay Moore plays like the sluggo, the local guy.
Yeah, Jay Moore's the local guy who's one of the who continues to live with his father.
Yeah.
And I'm the guy, I got married, but am having problems in my marriage. And then Leguizamo plays the guy who disappeared on us 8 years ago for God knows why and comes back to reveal his secret, kind of.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it good? Is it worth waiting for?
It is worth waiting for.
Yeah, and then is there one other guy? There's one other guy, the Scooby-Doo
guy. Yeah,
Matt
Lillard plays the guy who's kind of got it together, and he's really fantastic in this. He's the one with the kids.
Uh-huh.
With the family, who's like, look, you know, when you grow up and you have kids, life just changes, and that's the way it is. I have two kids, you know, and I have a bunch of friends who are still 35 going on 14.
Right.
Not understanding why you can't hang out all night and waiting for a check from mom and dad to pay their rent. And it's, you know, maybe that's just our generation. And this movie, I think, bridges the gap between some of that old school thinking about what defines, like, a man and responsibility, but still doesn't let everyone off the hook who behaves in that manner, you know?
Well, yeah, it is kind of weird because here I am. I'm probably a little older than you, but not much. I don't have kids. I'm on my second marriage. It seems like a lot of the emotional issues and responsibilities around family life are the same as they were when our parents were coming up, but it doesn't seem like our parents thought twice about having kids when they were like 20.
Yeah.
And it was just part of the game.
But when our parents were 20, the population of the Earth was 180,000, and now it's 6.4 billion.
Yeah, they shouldn't have done
that. No, it's a different time today, I guess.
Yeah, but it just seems like our ideas about children and about our own vanity and about our own perpetual adolescence are different. How old are your kids?
7 and 5.
Oh, so you've had them a while. You're used to it.
Not too long, yeah. But, you know, I understand exactly.